From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. One of the most jarring trends during the coronavirus pandemic is that Wall Street is booming while Americans are desperately struggling. The wealth of billionaires like Jeff Bezos has dramatically multiplied, even as tens of millions of Americans have lost jobs. Companies like Amazon have an outsized power in our society and economy. And writing about the massive monopolies that have emerged today is the well-known progressive figure Zephyr Teachout. She's an attorney, political activist, and antitrust and corruption expert. In 2018, she ran for New York Attorney General and was endorsed by Senator Bernie Sanders. She was part of the team of lawyers that sued Donald Trump for allegedly violating the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. Ms. Teachout sits on the board of directors of the Open Markets Institute and teaches law at Fordham University. And she joins me to discuss her new book called Break 'Em Up, Recovering Our Freedom from Big Ag, Big Tech, and Big Money. The book has a foreword by Senator Sanders. Welcome to the program, Zephyr.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, let's start with the idea that these companies have an outsized impact on our economy. There's a handful of them. And in fact, in one page of your book, you actually list them. They fit on less than a page. And I'm wondering if you can just give us a sampling of what these companies are. I mentioned Amazon and why they are such a problem and their size is such a problem.
Yeah. I think people have an intuitive a feeling of something being deeply, deeply, many things being deeply, deeply wrong in our economy and in our democracy. And the truth is, the problems with our economy and our democracy are deeply connected. One of the key problems is that we have allowed, really over the last 40 years, just this collapse of a handful of companies who gobbled up all these small and medium-sized companies, merged with other giants, and gradually grown so large and so powerful and come to be at bottlenecks, at choke points in our economy, that they are effectively a kind of private government. Now, they call themselves private sector, but when you look at the amount of control and power they exercise over us as workers, small business owners, and citizens, it looks a lot more like what we think of as governmental than private companies competing in an open market. This is true in tech, and there's been a lot of attention on tech recently with the hearings in Congress, which are a potentially very exciting moment where people are saying, hey, wait a second, this is grotesque. What's happening with the concentration of power there. But it's certainly also true in ag. It's true in office supplies. It's true in airlines. It's true in beer. You can buy, you know, you may think you have all these choices, but Budweiser and Beck's and hundreds of other brands are all owned in the back end by the same handful of companies. So we basically allowed for this collapse into these little tyrants that are sucking value and money out of the people who are creating value and money. So when you see this disconnect between extreme wealth and people just barely making do, one of the big machines that's allowed that to happen is the monopoly machine of these private governments.
You use the example of Mark Zuckerberg in your book, who, you know, he's just an individual, he's just a human being, but his whims and desires have massive impacts. And unfortunately, our politicians, especially those at the highest levels, take people like him and his ideas so seriously that his word effectively becomes policy. Can you expand a little bit more on that?
Yeah, I think Facebook in some ways is the easiest to show the ways in which something that is totally private and all about the profit motive has come to govern us. And we've kind of accepted that. Like when you think of who is making privacy policy right now, when Mark Zuckerberg speaks, it's basically as if we had appointed a privacy czar and the decisions have that level of power, as if it were a federal agency, in terms of the number of people who are impacted. But of course, Zuckerberg wasn't either himself elected or appointed by anybody who was elected or has any accountability mechanisms. And it's not just privacy. He's effectively, along with Google, becoming these really dangerous regulators of news and the news industry. Google and Facebook together really dominate the digital ad market. They've sucked away a lot of money from local newspapers, but they also control what's showing up in your feed, what shows up in your search results, and between the two of them have enormous control over the information that people get. Newspapers have been complaining, and last year Zuckerberg and Facebook set up a little team to say, no, we want to help newspapers and we're going to work with newspapers to make sure we promote their content. But that's also really dangerous. You don't want Zuckerberg teaming up as a kind of benign lord saying, no, I think we're going to let this newspaper do well and this one is going to be pushed down below. This is grotesque power over our public space. And even people who are mad at him, I think, tend to accept the naturalness of Facebook instead of what I think we should be doing is spending a lot more time pushing our elected officials to say, no, enough with private government. Not only do these companies need heavy regulation, they also should be broken up. Facebook has no business owning Instagram. We can have social media that isn't driven by a targeted ads business model. We should actually go at the root of their really toxic power.
In your chapter, The Chickenization of America, the American middle class, you point out Tyson Foods as a really important company to examine. And this is a company that in recent months has been under scrutiny because of the horrendous COVID outbreaks in meat processing plants among workers and President Trump's intervention of these workers to classify these workers as essential workers, even though he didn't use that same power to, for example, produce personal protective equipment, which we needed much more than we needed chicken. How does the monopoly that Tyson controls affect American economy and also what we eat and our jobs, our workers' rights?
Yeah, I mean, I start the book with food for a bunch of reasons. One is nobody can deny the essential nature of food. And the control and concentration in our food industry is not only leading to bad food, but it's leading to this extraordinary set of cruel systems that really not just diminish the wages, but are really deeply humiliating to chicken farmers and workers who work within these systems. It's basically as if you have Tyson, these big distributors, sitting like jailers at the center of a system, and they're able to look out at each of the individuals and spy on them and collect information from them and experiment on them and extract as much not just wealth but information from people as possible, and then themselves take all the value there. And I think what is so, there's a few things that are really important about this. One is that if this is happening in food, this is a model for what's happening everywhere in society. Second, it's that one of the things that I really focused on is the ways in which this humiliation leads to depression and despair and a kind of debilitating anger. And I think often when we talk about economics, we have ceded the language of who has the right to talk about economics and what's the right terms to these really dry terms. But the impacts of these power imbalances lead to an incredible amount of psychic pain. And I think we have to talk about that. And finally, I think it's really important to show how chicken farmers who are subject to this arbitrary experimenting, extractive power, their relationship to Tyson is so similar to Uber drivers' relationship to Uber, who also are subject to this tyrannical, experimental, extractive regime. And that relationship is also the same as Amazon sellers' relationship to Amazon, who takes as much as 30% of every sale and treats its own warehouse workers badly. So we're seeing in what we may think of as very different communities, really a really, really similar tyrannical business model. And I want to encourage us to forge unlikely alliances, to say, like, we've got to work together organizing franchisees whose relationship to the franchisor of McDonald's is also very similar. Franchisees working with chicken farmers, working with Uber drivers, working with Amazon warehouse workers, and all together taking on the shared enemy of these monopolistic tyrants.
In the same chapter around food, you raise another trend which has become markedly more prominent just during the pandemic, and which is how food production relates to food delivery services. And this is basically, I suppose, the future of how people eat, using, you know, apps that rely on technology that then coordinate with companies like Uber and the Postmates and Grubhub companies, all of which extract pretty significant commissions from usually small restaurants that, you know, and these restaurants feel like they have to join these programs in order to compete with the bigger chains. This also just seems to be a race to the bottom based on the monopoly pressures from top.
I mean, it was bad before. I finished the book before the pandemic.
I figured, yeah.
I want to rewrite it because there's so many ways in which we've seen how crazy and cruel this fragile system is. When you look at medical systems or the fragility in our hospital systems. But before the pandemic, it was already a problem. Now, think of restaurants. Think of your favorite restaurants and how important they are in a community and how central they are in building connections in a community. Restaurants who rely on delivery, which is increasingly almost all restaurants, as a key part of being able to survive on small margins, basically have to be on these big delivery platforms or it's a death sentence. If you have an amazing restaurant, but it isn't showing up on a seamless Grubhub, then most people aren't going to be able to find it. And so these platforms then have an incredible amount of control and can extract value from those restaurants, charging huge fees to be on the services. But that's just the first step. The next step, which you can see flows very naturally from what Amazon and Tyson and Uber have done, is for the delivery apps or platforms to peer in and gather a lot of data from those restaurants to basically force them to treat their workers worse, to extract the maximum value. And one of the things I care a lot about is I think there's a tendency on left and right, people who think this is terrible or people who think this is wonderful, to look at technology as somehow determinative. Like, well, this is the gig economy. And if you celebrate it, you think this is a wonderful feature of technology. And if what most of us see is the ways in which it's really hurting people, we say that technology caused this. And that's actually allowed lawmakers to avoid responsibility for not acting to totally stop this kind of abusive theft. It's not technology, it's a business model. We have tools to deal with this kind of thing. We're just choosing not to use it. And technology, I think, stands in the way. And people say, oh, it's tech. And they feel like there's nothing they can do.
You also talk about journalism in your book, which, of course, is obviously deeply personal for me. And we mentioned Jeff Bezos earlier, who owns the Washington Post. How has the monopoly power of these massive companies killed journalism, or, you know, at least maimed it?
Well, this is an area where, again, I think we've got it wrong culturally. We think, oh, the internet killed local newspapers because the internet came along and then newspapers could no longer survive. That is a simple story and it's a wrong story. It is true that in the early days of widespread internet usage, news sources lost some of their sources of revenue, but they still could survive on targeted ads. I mean, there's a handful of newspapers like the New York Times that can survive on subscriptions, basically. But most newspapers relied on local ads or ads to survive. That's like that was the business model. Google and Facebook came along and started doing something extraordinary. They started advertising next to the stories written by journalists who had done all the work. So basically, I use the example of the Daily News in New York, which was already struggling when I wrote the book, and they've just closed their newsroom. This is a really important working class newspaper in New York. And whether or not you agree with everything they say, it's like an incredible source of basic news. What's happening in a construction with the construction industry? So journalists do the hard work of telling the story of a horrific construction accident. That story gets shared on Facebook, and then Facebook is making the money that the Daily News used to make. And this is just sucking huge essential revenues, especially from local journalism and working class journalism, and the cost is amazing. And again, there's a technological determinism about it. We say, well, the internet did it, instead of, no, we actually should not allow Facebook and Google to play that kind of bridge troll choke point role. We can demand that they change their business model. We have agency to have a society where there's news and people have dignity, and people who create things earn the earn good wages for their creations, as opposed to a society where anytime there's a margin, you hear this great sucking sound, and it's going to one of a handful of monopolists.
So the theme, of course, is that these companies do what they can because they can get away with it and present it as inevitable, and our elected officials roll over and allow them to set the agenda. The solution is to reset the agenda, right? To start to apply laws that already exist. We have antitrust laws in this nation that have been used, but in the distant past. So is it a matter of just having the political will to apply these laws, or do we need new regulations for the digital age that we're living in now that really is, you know, in some ways unprecedented?
Yeah. I mean, I think all of the above. I think there's a few things that are very unique to the digital age. Like there's certain, we should ban facial recognition technology. There's certain kinds of data that shouldn't be allowed to be extracted, period. There's certain business models that shouldn't be allowed to exist for basically what are public utilities. We shouldn't allow Facebook and Google to use the targeted ad business model. We have a traditional way of providing essential communications infrastructure that does not require maximizing addiction and data and surveillance and collecting data. So those are particular changes that I think we need because of tech. But there is also this, like, I think of it as like a huge box of rusty, powerful tools that are just sitting there and just need some cleaning off to be used. I think when it comes to anti-monopoly, people now, not traditionally, now get really intimidated, and they feel, well, I don't know all the tools, and I don't know exactly what constitutes market share, and so I don't know. And they feel stuck and focus on other things. If I have one purpose here, it is to say, please don't be intimidated, because a root issue of so much that you care about is monopoly power. If we're just going to allow these companies to amass power, we're always going to end up begging them for scraps, as opposed to actually being able to have a fair and open and free society. And I really want to shake the shoulders of progressives to say, okay, you say you care about corporate concentration, you say you care about corporate power, but tell me, when is the last time you marched in the streets? When is the last time that you stood up and made a lot of noise with your local elected officials saying, why haven't you done anything about Facebook? There's really exciting things happening now. the new regulations on Uber and Lyft, for instance, are so critical. A lot of the excitement and energy is in California. There's amazing anti-Amazon work going on with a new coalition of labor and other groups coming together to say, this is an illegitimate company. And the key thing we're seeing in both of these areas, which is so essential, and I want to challenge everybody, but progressives to do more of this, is people are moving past a corporate accountability framework where you say, please be nicer, Jeff Bezos, and moving to a corporate illegitimacy framework, which is to say, these companies can't exist in this form. They either can become public utilities, or they can be broken up, or ideally, both.
A huge part of the problem is that the money that they sit on translates into political power simply because of our broken political system that allows corporations, through decisions like Citizens United, to wield enormous power to shape our discourse to begin with, right? I mean, this is a huge part of the problem, that people feel helpless because they're told that they have little power because these companies wield a lot of power. But, you know, maybe there's, once we pull back the curtain, there's not as much power as we think there is. So what are some of the ways in which these companies subvert our political process, subvert democracy itself, which ought not, should not to be a partisan issue?
No, this absolutely should not be. I mean, one of the side effects of Citizens United, which I have spent a lot of time writing about, was cited in the dissent of Citizens United. So I was writing about Citizens United before it came, before it was decided. This real threat to our already fragile democracy. One of the side effects has been growing employer ability to have control over, spy on, retaliate against workers for their political activity. Because what Citizens United did is it said, oh, corporations, as so long as they aren't coordinating with a candidate, have unlimited political speech rights. So now you take Citizens United on the one hand and surveillance capacity on the other, and you join them, and suddenly at work, you have employers who are in some cases already using this power, and in other cases just sort of building capacity to punish, to spy on people's social media accounts and listen into conversations at work. And the impact is not just when the companies in fact act and in fact tell an employee, you're out of here for political reasons. It's that the fear of them acting has a profound impact. It really makes it harder to unionize. It makes it harder to organize. And the number of people who are afraid of political retaliation in work is really going up. And who can blame them? That hammer is sitting there. And of course, that threat of retaliation is so much more dangerous when you have a concentrated economy. If you've got one of only a few companies that you can work for in whatever field you're in, getting fired by one company when, by the way, they're kind of in the same club as the other company is really, really dangerous. So it has this major impact on our politics. I mean, this connects to your last question, which is to say, this is tough. I mean, this is, I'm not talking about small challenges here. It's not about just simply flipping a switch and then we'll enforce antitrust laws again. I do think it will require movement work. It will require more than understanding all the intricacies of what predatory pricing is or how we can enforce against tying contracts. I just use that's a technical term from antitrust law. More important is the grassroots work, because people are scared and I don't blame them. They feel alone and fragile and I don't blame them. But it means that we have to do as much work as possible to create moments of solidarity and opportunities to say, This is a democracy moment for us. Concentrated corporate power is a threat to people governing themselves. we're told we're free, but we're not stupid. We can see the ways in which we're not free.
Right. And the companies that you single out in your book that I mentioned that, earlier in our conversation, fit on less than a page, impact all of us. You know, there probably isn't a single person in America that isn't impacted by at least one, if not five or 10 of these companies: Amazon, Alphabet, Google, Monsanto, Bayer, Spectrum, Pfizer, Uber, Visa, Unilever, Verizon, Exxon, Bank of America, Citibank, Common Spirit Health, Disney, CVS, Nestle, United Healthcare, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Comcast, Boeing, and Walmart. You know, I can probably say that at least half of those I interact with, but the other half I probably interact with, but just don't know I interact with, because they're fronts for smaller companies or whatever.
And I do feel, just to be clear, that isn't the list of all companies that need to be broken up, but it's a example list. One of the things that
it's a good place to start, I guess.
It's a place to start. One of the companies on that list, which is, I think, a really important area, just to look at consolidation in hospitals and hospital networks, that you see people are really focused, understandably, on their insurance company. And I am a major supporter of Medicare for All. I think it's absolutely morally necessary. Most of people's interactions with the healthcare system start with the insurance company. But the truth is, a lot of the extraordinary gross costs come from consolidation among hospitals. And there's a lot of good research that shows that when you consolidate hospitals, first of all, you lose the kind of redundancy that you need in a crisis like this. It's been called the Great American Bedshed, when we lost so many hospital beds because people said, how few do we need, not how many do we need? But also, they can start to charge enormous amounts, because if you have a consolidated, if you have one hospital in a region instead of three or four, that's the hospital. They set the price.
That's the local monopoly. Yeah.
And it's true whether or not, and this is important, it's true whether or not they are technically for-profit or not-for-profit, because not-for-profit hospitals are money-making machines too. It's not that title alone doesn't tell you whether or not the people at the top are making a gross amount of money off of people suffering. And consolidation in the healthcare sector, I think, is something we have to deal with. Medicare for All, yes. And at the same time, we don't want a public insurer to be negotiating with one or two Goliaths who basically can set the terms, driving up prices.
Right. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Zephyr. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Zephyr Teachout, attorney, political activist, antitrust and corruption expert. She ran for New York Attorney General in 2018. She sits on the board of directors of the Open Markets Institute and teaches law at Fordham University. We've been discussing her new book, Break 'em Up, Recovering Our Freedom from Big Ag, Big Tech, and Big Money. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.